Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our fall membership drive. More about that in just a sec. Today we're talking about bourbon, how it's made, and what makes it good. Tim Barra has taught biology, human anatomy, ecology, evolution, marine biology, and ichthyology. It is the study of fish, to college students for decades. He's written many books and joined the show to talk about some of them in the past. The topic may not be in his academic wheelhouse per se, but bourbon goes way back with Tim Barra. He's written a new book on the topic titled Bourbon, What the Educated Drinker Should Know. Welcome back to the show, Tim Barra.
Well, it's good to be here. I never thought I'd be here with a book about bourbon.
I never did either.
Last visit with Charles Darwin and his children
and
brought me here.
And then I think before that was Charles Darwin.
Yes, one thing led to another, but how I got to bourbon is totally different.
And I want to talk about that. The book, Bourbon, What the Educated Drinker Should Know. It's written by Tim Barra. He's an Ohio State professor emeritus, my guest today. This book is a thorough summary of bourbon facts. It's a great reference volume. It's the perfect guide to the history and science behind this favorite drink. And as a true academician, Tim Barra has included a very detailed index. The book is an authoritative guidebook on all things bourbon, written in a straightforward, easy to understand format, which we're going to talk about. It answers the question, what is bourbon? And it has a helpful glossary of terms with beautiful full color photos, hundreds to accompany them. All right, Tim Barra, all bourbon is whiskey, but not all whiskey is bourbon. Why?
Well, because of the definition of whiskey, things like Scotch, Irish, Canadian, Japanese, bourbon, rye, all fit that definition. But the definition of bourbon is of a subcategory of whiskey that has certain parameters. To be called bourbon, first of all, it has to be made in the United States. You cannot make bourbon anywhere else.
Why is that?
Well, the Congress in 1964 passed that rule. I mean, it's the same thing for Scotch. You can only make Scotch in Scotland. It's one of these geographical definitions, like champagne. Mm-hmm. You can't call sparkling wine from California champagne. It has to be made in Champagne region of France. Bourbon has carved out that identity for itself. Must be made in the United States. It's a myth that people say to me often, oh, it's not made in Kentucky, therefore it isn't bourbon. Mm-hmm. That isn't true. Although 95% of all bourbon is made in Kentucky, you can make it anywhere in the United States. Wyoming bourbon is terrific stuff. You know, make it anywhere. It has to be aged in new charred oak containers. So you can only use them once. Well, what happens to them after you've dumped out the bourbon? Interestingly, they're sold to Scotland, and Scotch is aged in bourbon barrels. So I tell my Scotch-drinking friends, that's why it's so good. There's a couple gallons of bourbon embedded in the wood. So when they fill it with Scotch in Scotland, that moves in and out. The bourbon moves in and out of the liquid in there for years and flavors the Scotch. Other features of bourbon are... you can't add anything except water. No color, no flavor, no nothing. When you are distilling it, you can go no higher than 160 proof. You stop it at that point. Now, vodka, which is one of the most popular drinks there is, and it's a big nothing. Vodka is distilled to 190 proof, which means there's no color, no flavor, no taste, no aroma, no nothing. People who argue about the different brands of vodka, that this $50 Grey Goose is better than the $10 pair, well, they're all just drinking ethanol, you know, neutral spirits. So you stop bourbon distillation at 160. You then put it into the barrel at no more than 125 proof. So you have to dilute it from the still with distilled water, put it in the barrel at less, or 125 proof or less, and then when you bottle it, it can be bottled at no less than 80 proof. So those rules determine what can be called bourbon.
Why so many rules? Who cares?
Well, it's truth in advertising, because right after Prohibition, there were all kinds of weird whiskeys showing up. People would take vodka or neutral spirits and add coloring, add creosote, add iodine, and sell it as whiskey. You know, and this eventually led to consumer legislation to have truth in advertising. So bourbon was the first real product that brought us consumer legislation.
You were talking about the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, and it is shocking what forced government officials to step in. Now, is there any fears?
Well, you do have to read labels carefully and understand them. Everything is defined so that there is enforcement of this. You're not going to be buying really rubbish stuff that has the word bourbon on the label.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important parts of the definition is that it has to be from a mash bill or grain recipe of a minimum of 51% corn.
The mash bill is another phrase for the grain recipe.
Recipe, okay. Yes. And there's a great variety of that in real bourbons, and it really just depends on the distiller. One isn't necessarily better than the other. You decide what you like personally. Most bourbons are somewhere in the realm of about 70% corn. And then there is a secondary grain. Now, that is usually rye, say 20% rye, and then 10% barley. And the barley is used for the enzymes that break down the starches into the sugars and so forth so the yeast can digest it. But you can also substitute wheat for the rye.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a wheated bourbon or a rye bourbon. And you can manipulate these numbers a few percent to give the flavor profile that the distiller wants.
So there's rye, there's wheat, and there's also barley.
Mm-hmm.
There is no oatmeal.
Well, there are some craft distillers that are making bourbon partially with oat grain. So grain is the essential thing, and oat is a grain.
What's the difference, let's say, between rye and wheat? When you talk about that flavor profile, mm-hmm. What can we make of that?
Well, rye tends to be sharper, more peppery, more spicy, whereas a wheated bourbon, wheat is not so overwhelming, and it allows more of the corn sweetness to show through and tends to be sort of a softer, sweeter taste. Some people like one, some people like the other.
Kind of
like
the bread,
them both,
right?
Depending on, yeah, like bread.
Sometimes I feel like some rye.
That's right.
And sometimes I feel like
yeah.
wheat. Yeah.
It depends on the mood and the occasion, and, you know, they're all good.
And then barley.
Barley is necessary because it has special enzymes that when it is malted, which means it's allowed to germinate, then you stop the germination. Those enzymes are ready. When you put that in the recipe, in the mash bill, and cook it, those enzymes start breaking down the starches of the corn and the rye into more simple sugars, which can then be digested by the yeast, and that's where the alcohol comes from.
Yay.
Yay, yes.
A lot of people associate bourbon with Kentucky, as you said. Mm-hmm. Why is it that it has such a strong history in Kentucky?
Well, Kentucky is the perfect place for making bourbon. It has a wonderful water supply throughout the whole state because of the limestone layer under Kentucky.
So it's the water.
Well, that's one of the reasons.
Okay.
The water is filtered through this limestone, which removes iron. Iron is the enemy of bourbon. So it has great water. And when Kentucky was first settled, its soil was so incredibly fertile and people were growing corn. Well, you have to do something with this corn. Now, you can ship it out in bushels, which are heavy and so forth, but distillation is a way of converting those bushels of corn into a more easily transported liquid, and that became part of farming. Distillation was part of all farmers' activity, like making candles or making soap or something. So that was an easier way that was to transport, which was even more valuable. Kentucky passed a law to get itself settled, the Karn and Cabin Act, which gave 400 acres to anyone moving, say, from Pennsylvania or Maryland, where they made rye, move into Kentucky. We'll give you 400 acres if you plant corn and build a cabin. And that led to this. And, one distiller sort of begat another, and Kentucky is full of distillers, some really large and some small craft. But about 95% of all bourbon is made in Kentucky. But it can be made anywhere in the United States.
How did Prohibition change the trajectory of bourbon as a consumable?
Oh, well, it almost destroyed it. Hmm. I mean, it wiped it out virtually for 13 years. However, there were six distillers that got medicinal whiskey permits. So they were allowed to make it for medicinal
consumption. Are they the ones we're very familiar with today,
well,
by coincidence?
Well, through various iterations, they've come and gone and been bought and sold. But okay. Yes, they are still around in some format today. And that allowed bourbon to survive. And of course, you had to have a physician's prescription to get your little bottle of bourbon in that time. And that brought on many, many illnesses because people wanted that prescription. And bourbon survived because of that. It turned something like Walgreens drugstores into de facto liquor stores. I mean, I think Walgreens owned about 11 drugstores in Chicago when Prohibition started, and he owned over 500 when it ended.
Wow.
So he could sell the liquor. You know, it was a really historic time in America.
It also almost wiped out the beer business.
Oh,
only
everything.
The big beer makers survived.
Yeah.
How big is bourbon outside of the United States? Is it coveted?
Yes, and more so all of the time. Now, Scotch is the biggest selling whiskey. About twice as much Scotch by volume is sold as bourbon. But to the bourbon, you can add the Canadian and the other forms of whiskey. Scotch is still the biggest of all of the kinds of whiskey available. But bourbon is on the ascendancy, and there's a real interest in craft bourbons these days, where small distilleries set about making things. And in fact, we have one right here in Columbus, downtown near Fifth and High, Midwest Spirits.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrific place,
right.
And they make an excellent bourbon. And it's very small. If you take a tour, you'll see all this gleaming, beautiful copper work and so forth. Well, places like that are springing up all over America, turning out their own unique kinds of bourbon.
Let's talk about that label on bourbon and whiskey. I mean, or I should say whiskey in general, where it identifies it as bourbon. What can somebody who's not educated get from that label?
Well, there's some interesting nuances to looking at these labels. For example, a lot of people have the misconception, they'll say, oh, bourbon must be aged X number of years to be called bourbon. That isn't correct. 2 minutes in a new charred oak vessel makes it bourbon. However, what they're thinking about is the term straight bourbon. That does have an age requirement. So you're better off looking for a label on the bottle that says straight bourbon. Now, it might say Kentucky straight bourbon or Virginia straight bourbon or whatever the state it was distilled in, but straight is the term. Now, to be called straight bourbon, it must be aged a minimum of 2 years in the new charred oak. If it's aged more than 4 years or more, you do not have to put an age date on there. So if it says straight bourbon and there's no age date, you know it's at least 4 years old. But if it's 2 or 3 years old, it will say age 2 years or age 36 months. So that tells you something right there.
You were talking about Kentucky as one of the reasons why it's so well known is because of the water. And I was wondering about, does that handicap other places? I mean, how do people not in Kentucky? I mean, where do you get your water from?
Well, you have to do some water tests and chemistry before you locate a distillery. And if you can find usually spring water is in the vicinity of limestone, so you hunt for that sort of things. But there are distilleries that simply use the city water from wherever they happen to be, because that is also treated and filtered and so forth, so it is removing the nasty that can get into it. So it's not essential that you be in Kentucky, but it is essential that you have pristine waters, whether it comes from the city's treatment plant or from a spring. It doesn't make that much difference.
There's the liquid of the spent mash. It's known as setback.
Yes, that's another good point to talk about. Bourbon is made by the sour mash process. 99% of all bourbons are sour mash. What that means is that after the mash bill has been distilled, a portion of that, maybe as much of a third, is taken out of the still and put back in the next batch that's cooking. That's why it's called a setback.
Yeah.
What that does is keep the pH more or less constant. It tends to be towards the acid side, and that's what the yeast want. That's creating the best possible environment and giving a consistent product from one distillation to the next, to the next, to the next. They keep putting the setback.
That's where the continuity comes
from. And that gives continuity, and that's the sour mash. Not all bourbons put that on their label, but almost all bourbons are made with a sour mash process. There are a few that use a sweet mash, and that means every bottling is different from every other. Every distillation is different from every other because it doesn't get that same yeast that the previous distillation used.
If you have a question about anything about bourbon, you can give us a call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. And Bob in Pataskala, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Ann. This is an absolutely fascinating show. My question is, Jack Daniel's likes to call itself Tennessee whiskey, Tennessee sipping whiskey. Is it, in fact, a bourbon?
Well, that's a common question I get, and I address this in the book in a very straightforward way by saying yes and no. There is no reason Jack Daniel's cannot be called a bourbon. It meets all of the requirements of bourbon. You know, it has the same kind of mash bill, new charred oak, all the things about bourbon are present for Jack Daniel's. However, it is a marketing decision by Brown-Forman, who own the company, to call it a Tennessee whiskey. They want to set themselves apart from bourbon. Now, it is made in Tennessee, so they're creating a niche, Tennessee whiskey. But there's nothing about it that isn't bourbon. Now, what Jack Daniel's will say is, oh, well, we use the Lincoln County process, therefore it's different. Lincoln County process is a charcoal filtration situation where they take what they have distilled before they put it in the barrel and run it through a huge charcoal column, sort of like an aquarium filter. And the activated charcoal, which is maple wood, that has been burned into charcoal, it filters out various congeners that have escaped the distillation. That gives Jack Daniel's this sort of smooth finish, and, you know, it's a bit sweeter than many bourbons. And so they want to say, well, we use the Lincoln County process, so we're calling ourselves Tennessee whiskey. The Lincoln County process does not invalidate the name bourbon, but it does more or less describe a Tennessee whiskey. But there are other bourbons that are also charcoal filtered and just don't make a big deal out of it.
I promised at the beginning of the program that we'd talk about how you got into drinking bourbon.
Well,
you were quite young.
Yes. I was a little boy growing up in St. Louis, and my dad and my uncles, they were all bourbon drinkers. So my dad would teach me how to make a cocktail, you know, an old-fashioned or a whiskey sour or a highball. And so I just did it. Just something I grew up with. I was never a particularly big drinker of it, but I did like a highball from time to time. And nothing really happened for decades after that. But a trip to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail which I highly recommend for every listener who's interested in bourbon. You read my book and then go visit. Mm. And you can go to any of, 12, 14 distilleries, pick a couple, and take a long weekend in Kentucky. Make Bardstown your sort of center, your base. And each morning, drive out in a different direction. You'll visit a different distillery and take these tours and do the tastings. It's amazing what you'll learn doing that, especially if you've read the book.
For a long time, though, the bourbon distilleries kind of operated quietly. It's just become sort of a thing now.
Yes, it has become very trendy, and these distilleries are now a destination. I mean, this is millions of dollars of tourism for Kentucky to these distilleries, and they're springing up everywhere. There are new ones coming up, but the big names like Jim Beam and Four Roses and Wild Turkey and Woodford Reserve and so forth, go to those and take the tour. There's nothing more interesting than being in a rickhouse surrounded by thousands of barrels of bourbon, and you breathe that in, this amazing aroma. It's known as the angel's share. That's the evaporation through the wood of the bourbon as it ages. So the angels are getting their drink. And it's just lovely. I mean, I love being in there and breathing in deeply.
And you could smell the differences.
Well, yes, you can
just
smell.
Just like you can, when you...
In different distilleries, if you get pretty adept at this, you may be able to recognize where you are. But it all has this general bourbon aroma, which is a wonderful scent.
You were talking earlier about, Midwest spirits and their beautiful gleaming copper. I guess they're the stills, right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's a column and a pot. Mm-hmm. Those are two different kinds of stills. What's the diff?
Well, Scotch, for example, has been made in pot stills for...
And what do those look like?
Well, they look like a gourd or a bottle, whereas most bourbon is distilled in column stills, which are very tall, thin structures. Some of them can be, 60 feet tall. Oh. Others are half that size. And there are little partitions all the way up. So you put the mash that has been cooked and fermented at the top, and you put steam at the bottom. Now, the mash trickles down through openings in plates at certain intervals. The steam is rising. That steam then is heating the mash and removing the alcohol, because that boils at a lower temperature than water. So that goes up with the steam. It's then condensed, and then it's redistilled, usually in a pot still, or can be in a pot still, which takes out even more of the unpleasant congeners that are in the alcohol. That is what is called the white dog that you would then accumulate until you've got enough to put it in the barrels. And so you put it in the barrels and let it age in the rickhouse. And after it reaches the flavor profile that the master distiller wants, you bottle it. So if you take bourbon that, say, has aged in the barrels for 10 years, put it in a bottle, keep that bottle for 10 years, you do not have 20-year-old bourbon. It's only
unlike wine, for instance.
That works with wine, but not with bourbon. Mm-hmm. It only ages within the barrel because it's the barrel with that charred oak that's giving 100% of the color to bourbon, and maybe 75% of the flavor comes from the wood sugars that are part of the oak.
Is that color like the tannins from the wood?
Well, that's part of it, yes. But it's also because of the charring.
Okay.
You've blackened it. That kind of breaks up that surface that allows the alcohol to penetrate, so it moves in and out of the wood with the change in temperature in the rickhouse. Now, if it's stored at the top of a 9-story rickhouse, the temperature up there may be 38 degrees higher than at the bottom of the rickhouse. So distillers keep track of how their barrels are aging, and they tend to mix barrels from high, low, middle, center, east side, west side to get the flavor they want. But they can also notice that, gee, these barrels on the fifth level on the east wall, they have a special property. We're going to bottle those barrels as a small batch or as a single barrel bourbon. And they'll charge more for that because they have something's magical happens in this layer, you know, or in this area. And that's part of the art of making bourbon.
Why can't they reuse barrels?
Well, legally, it can only be used once. So it's written into the law. This came about as a way of increasing jobs for making barrels. Use them once, you have to get rid of them, so you have to make more. This was an economic thing from the Great Depression and so forth to stimulate jobs, because Prohibition killed so many jobs, not just the tavern industry, but the bottling industry, the distillers, the coopers, and so forth. So let's make people use new barrels. And that first usage of the barrel gives you the best, the most flavorful, the most powerful.
But and the Scotch makers in Scotland like to use the barrels.
They use them because they don't want that strong oak, woody flavor.
They want it to be used.
They want it to be a used barrel because bourbon has already sort of cured it, so to speak. And think of the difference in Scotland and Kentucky's climate. Kentucky's very hot and humid and has a real summer and winter and so forth. Scotland is kind of drizzly and cool much of the time of the whole year. So many scotches are aged much longer than bourbon because a year in a Scottish rickhouse isn't nearly the same as a year in a bourbon rickhouse. Plus, it's an already used barrel, so they do it differently. An 18-year-old Scotch, if you put that in a new charred oak barrel, it might be undrinkable as too woody and so forth. So, you know, the Scotch people know what they're doing,
too. They know what they're doing. Tim Barrett, you know, what did inspire you to write this book? You said you were writing a blog, right? Or
no, I don't.
Okay.
I don't do blogs. I don't even own a cell phone. I'm one of those guys.
That's right. You're one of those
I'm
guys.
I'm unusual. Yeah. But I got interested in learning more myself. So besides going to the Bourbon Trail, I took courses from Woodford Reserve's Bourbon Academy. And then there's a place in Louisville known as Moonshine University. And they offer a course and a credential. So I'm an executive bourbon steward. But you take courses and exams. The more I learned, the more I enjoyed it. You know, knowing something enhances enjoyment. The more I enjoyed the bourbon, and I realized that, geez, every bourbon I had tastes a little different than every other bourbon. And why is that? And I started getting deeper and deeper and tasting more and more, and the outcome is I've got 175 bourbons in my library that's starting to displace my books. I can hardly walk
around.
That's
inconceivable.
Well, you know, yeah. But so I started giving lectures. People would ask me, I gave talks on bourbon. And I kept getting these same questions over and over. There is so much misunderstanding about what is bourbon. Everybody who drinks it thinks they know something about it, and actually they don't know very much about it. So I thought, let me put it all in one place. One thing led to another, and I wanted to, you know, I read 40 different books to write this, and I realized, well, geez, the world doesn't need another 250-page book about bourbon. What it needs is my PowerPoint presentation with pictures and bullet points.
Lots of pictures.
This idea to, can we make a book that is something like a PowerPoint, but yet is a proper-looking book? And the publisher, Acclaim Press out of Missouri, just did a gorgeous job of this. So
super
the front
nice.
Part of the book, you know, the left and right-hand page represents one slide of my PowerPoint, although in a book-like format. The back of the book is further explanations of what's on that. So you can quickly go through the front for Bourbon for Beginners And then you can read the notes in the back as the advanced course to understand more deeply what those bullet points meant.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm a bourbon man, but I was reading a book about scotch once, and they claimed that the hype about single barrel and all this kind of stuff was a lot of hype, that they had spent 100 years or longer learning how to blend it so you could come up with the ideal drink. Since any one barrel is liable to have a little too much of this or a little too little of that, blending got a bad name because it was a way to get rid of crummy stuff or a way of just diluting stuff with neutral grain spirits and the like. I wonder what you think, if that's true on bourbon, that maybe some of the single barrel stuff where people will pay $1,000 for a bottle of bourbon is hype.
Yes. In a word, there's a lot of puffery on bourbon labels and a lot of overcharged imaginations about what you're saying. Whether a given individual could tell the difference between the regular bourbon of a particular brand and a single barrel bourbon with the same recipe and so forth, it's sort of debatable. It really is a personal preference. And, you know, I went to an auction a couple of days ago. I mean, it's gotten so crazy that I stood in line for an hour and a half to get a ticket that would then be drawn for the privilege of buying this bourbon for $250. And my number didn't get called, and there were only 11 barrels.
Would you have bought it?
Well, I went there, so yes. I had to drive, you know, away from my house and so forth to get to this place. And I've done that on several occasions. I mean, the big hype is Pappy Van Winkle's. Everybody wants that. And, you know, on eBay, they're $3,000 a bottle for the 23-year-old.
Wow.
I actually went to a tasting where there were all 6 expressions of the Van Winkle products, and I paid a lot to do that. But my personal favorite in there was the 12-year-old, not the 23-year-old, not the 20, not the 50. I really thought the 12 was perfect. But that's just my taste. You know, there is no right answer to what's the best bourbon, or, you know, what I taste is not going to be what you taste. Your taste buds are all different. Your experience is different. But I have kind of grown to know or to realize that you can actually taste certain things. I mean, the first time you taste butterscotch or vanilla or cinnamon or something in a bourbon, it's sort of an aha moment, because you read these descriptions from whiskey writers about what they taste. Oh, man, do they have imaginations? But occasionally, I actually get the same note. So, you know, it's an acquired skill, and the more you practice, the better you get.